in the west at 6, 68 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show in the heart of rural America, and a particular corner of rural America. And this is a place in Pennsylvania that is sort of at the crossroads between what we think of as the Rust Belt and Appalachia. And in this county, I believe Crawford County in Pennsylvania, a college professor by the name of Matthew Ference undertook a long-shot political campaign running for office in a county that has been decidedly Republican and conservative for as long as just about anybody can remember. And his experience of undertaking this political campaign is told in a really illuminating book called I Hate It Here, Please Vote for Me, Essays on Rural Political Decay. Matthew Ference teaches creative writing at Allegheny College, and he is actually originally from this part of America, so he knows it well and writes about it with great honesty, affection, and some dismay as well, although he reserves probably his greatest dismay for sort of the political forces in our country that seem to be driving us into an ever-widening political divide that is so bitter. And in particular, the way in which so much of rural America has been, in a sense, abandoned by the Democratic Party. That is, they have, in a sense, capitulated, surrendered, and are choosing to devote their time and energy and resources to other places, in a sense leaving many progressively minded rural Americans disenfranchised and unrepresented. He explores all of this and more in this really wonderful book. He's also responsible for a previous memoir called Appalachia North. This newest book, again, is called I Hate It Here, Please Vote for Me, Essays on Rural Political Decay, published by West Virginia University Press. Matthew Ference, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm really excited to be speaking with you. I think it might be helpful for us to, first of all, get kind of a sketch of your connection with this part of the country. And do I remember that it's tucked up in northwest Pennsylvania? Am I remembering that right?
Yes, you're remembering exactly correctly. So if you imagine the state of Pennsylvania, it's a rectangle that on the right-hand side is squiggly from rivers, and then there's a little notch that moves up north in the northwest corner, and we're up in that notch in Crawford County, which is one county below Lake Erie, which means we're one county below Canada. So it's an interesting part of the state in that this county is very conservative. Erie County, just north of us, is considered a bellwether county that's traditionally strong labor. And the district where I ran for office was mostly Crawford County and did have a swath of Erie County. So it ran all the way up to the lake. So I like to with an international district in some ways.
One of the things you talk about at some length in your book is this notion of being native versus being an outsider, or if we want to talk about plants, native plants versus invasives. And in a right. sense, you have an identity that is, you know, maybe a bit complicated for some people to appreciate. That is, you have undeniable roots to this region, and yet there are things about you and about your life that would make you, in the eyes of at least some of the citizens of Crawford County, an outsider. Explain to our listeners exactly where you come from and a bit of kind of your life's arc, which ultimately took you to Crawford County, where you undertook this political campaign back in 2020.
Right, yeah. So I grew up in Indiana County in western Pennsylvania, which is a county shaped exactly like the state of Indiana. And it's down in the southwest portion of the state, about an hour east of Pittsburgh, in the coal country of Pennsylvania, though the mines have been closed almost completely since the 1970s. So I was born there. I grew up there. We lived on a farm. And, you know, I showed goats at the county fair, and so I participated in all of the rural things that happened in that county. But my father was also a biology and environmental science professor at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, which at the time was the largest state university, state-owned university in the state. So I've always bridged a gap between exactly what people think of when they think of rural America, and also growing up as a kid who played music, saxophone player, was in drama and all of that. And my claim in the book is that there's nothing actually inconsistent about that identity, is that there are lots of people like me in lots of rural places all across the United States. And so I wound up eventually, I wandered around a little bit in life, lived in Arizona for a while, lived in France for a while. When we returned to Western Pennsylvania, my wife is from Johnstown, Pennsylvania, famous for the floods. We resettled back in Western Pennsylvania, an academic, wound up with a job in Northwestern PA, about 2 hours north of where I grew up. And when I ran for office, one of the digs against me was that I wasn't from here, even though the county that I grew up in is classified in exactly the same way as Crawford County. Crawford and Indiana kind of have the same economic fortunes. They have the same political structures. And so it was narratively a really interesting moment to be exiled from the place you're from. And then also frustrating in that that exile is extremely effective because of the way political narratives are drawn and the idea that someone who believes in things as I do just doesn't count as being from this part of the country. That's one of the main strains of the book and why that's such a problem for politics and for everybody living, well, kind of everywhere in the United States, but particularly in rural spots.
Right. You do take a moment to talk about Allegheny College and its place in the community. And as someone who also teaches at a college, I found this especially interesting. And I also, in addition to teaching in a college now, I grew up in a small town in Iowa that had a small liberal arts college in it. And my dad, who happened to be a pastor, has very vivid memories and some painful memories of the very sharp divide in what's sometimes called town and gown. And our particular congregation certainly had lots and lots of faculty from the college, and then lots and lots of pig farmers and others, other, you know, more kind of blue collar folks from the town. And although there was certain level of cordiality, there was a very, very sharp split in terms of how people saw the world and, for instance, the Vietnam War raging at the time. And this is a reality that is, of course, part of your life, too, and that really touched on this political campaign that you undertook in 2020.
Yeah, absolutely. So the quick history of Allegheny College is that it's one of the oldest small colleges in the country, and it was founded actually, if you look at the charter of the city of Meadville, where it's located, the college was founded before the city as a frontier college of someone who, Timothy Alden, who came west and wanted to establish a high caliber liberal arts education for a region that basically would have been ignored by civilization in big glowing scare quotes there in the East. And so the history of the town and the college actually grow up together. So they're essentially siblings, but one sibling became the one that counts as being from here. The other sibling is the college that is frequently politically portrayed as an outsider. And part of what I write about, what's complicated, is that it's not uncommon for folks who move in from the college to not be welcomed, first of all, by the city and by the county in particular, but also not be very welcoming to the folks who live here. So you have that inherent philosophical divide that on the day-to-day can be fine. People live next door to each other. But in that macro political way, when it comes to election time, there's a huge division. Even recently, there have been some of the most farthest right candidates for city council have wanted to explicitly prohibit college students from voting in city elections, which is illegal. They can't actually prohibit it. But they claim that the college students are ruining the politics of the town because they're able to vote. And that's kind of that broader context that we're living in.
We're speaking with Matthew Ferentz about his book, I Hate It Here, Please Vote for Me, Essays on Rural Political Decay. It talks about his experience in 2020 when he undertook a political campaign and undertook it with, I'm guessing, little if any expectation of winning. I think you hoped you would at least do well. And I guess I want to touch right here on the fact that we learn really early in the book. I mean, it might be by page two. We learn, I mean, because you tell us that you ultimately do lose this campaign. In fact, you even spell out right off the bat the margin of defeat. And it turned out to be for the incumbent who beat you. I think you say something like the largest margin of victory that he had yet experienced. I'm curious about your decision, and you're someone who teaches creative writing, and this is a wonderfully written book, but you made a choice there that you know somebody else might have not made, to tell us all of that right off the bat. So we read this book in a sense with not very much in the way of suspense about how is this going to turn out? Is he going to be successful in this bid? Can you tell us a little bit about your decision to let us in on the end of the story right at the outset?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was a draft of this book where literally the first sentence was, I lost. And from a concept of the book perspective, there is no suspense in a progressive runs in a district that's very red. You know they're going to lose. And so much of what I'm writing about, one of the things I said in the election is that we live the stories we tell and the stories that are told about us. And it's my belief that most of our political problems actually can be reduced to narrative problems, that we keep telling the same stories over and over again. And so for me to write a book that was just I ran and here's what happened, oh, by the way, I lost, if that's the traditional narrative arc of the book, it's not actually doing anything to change how we think about the stories that prevail in politics. And what I wanted to get at was it's not so much the losing, it's the how we lose that's the real problem. Because when we just think about the story of, well, if it's a red district and someone who's blue runs, they lose, and vice versa, then all we're doing is telling the same story that maintains the world as it is. And we need, well, if we want the world to not be as it is, and I don't, I want the world to be better, we need to think about the story that's super familiar and get at why that keeps happening. So my narrative functioned from that frustration or had an origin in that frustration that in some ways I thought I would win. I'm a little bit naive and maybe overly optimistic. I figured out pretty quickly that I wasn't, But I had that notion that, well, if someone ran on issues and explained them well and talked about how the politics that we have is not helping us, then you'd really have a chance. And then I found that that was absolutely not true, because the story of voter registration is the story of political success or failure. So I wanted to structure the story to explore something different. And so the narrative arc is, and it's a collection of essays, but they still hold together with a broader arc of how, when we reflect on what's happened, we can start to see the moments where our experience is causing an outcome that most people are dissatisfied with. And so that's really why the book was built in the way that it was built. Right. And then I tried to end it on hope, because even though I get frustrated a lot and am a little scared about the future of the country, I remain 100% hopeful that we can do better for everyone and we can be what America always claims it is.
It would be interesting to know a little more about what prompted you to undertake this effort, to run for office in a place where the odds were, to say the least, stacked against you. I wonder how much of that decision had to do with something that you had experienced not too long before, when you were diagnosed with a brain tumor and ended up finding yourself staring at your own mortality in a way that obviously had to be pretty sobering and frightening. How much, if at all, did that figure into your decision to take a crack at political office?
Yeah, there's no doubt that that was a significant part of the motivation. Sort of, you know, as a writer, I'm always thinking about character motivation. And that's an inflection point in my life that motivates a lot of action. That when I was like 40 years old when I was diagnosed with a brain tumor, and everything's fine now. But, you know, that is very sobering to be facing your mortality. You have young children, all of that. And so that gives me, in a conceptual, philosophical way, the desire to make the most out of the life that I have and we all have, to continually make it better for other people. And at the same time, there was a policy reason that motivated me to run. I have good health insurance, or what counts as good health insurance in the United States. And despite that, the cost of having a brain tumor, which is just, you know, a roll of the dice, was so enormous and such a pressure on our family budget. It took us 5 years, I would say, to get back to not having to deal with a debt that we had, that we were able to deal with because I have a good job and good health insurance. But that was a really poignant reminder of the many people who don't have good health insurance and don't have the financial means to recover from something like that, and how the narrative story, Red Blue, winds up leaving a lot of people around me here in Crawford County really susceptible to bankruptcy from healthcare. In fact, as part of the campaign, I interviewed both a physician, a neurologist at the local hospital, and the director of the local hospital, who later actually served as the Secretary of Health in Pennsylvania. And they were talking about the financial strains on the hospital system because so few people have the means or the insurance to cover it. So life, narrative, policy intersect in my reckoning of that brain tumor of what it means. So I guess I had to run in that context. And I'm sure we'll get to it. Poetry had a lot to do with why I ran, too, but
right.
That's a different question.
Right. And I am excited to talk about that. We're speaking with Matthew Ferentz, author of I Hate It Here, Please Vote for Me, Essays on Rural Political Decay. The book springs from his experience of running unsuccessfully for political office back in 2020 in the decidedly red county of Crawford County, where he lives and works as a professor of creative writing at Allegheny College. When you talk about your background and growing up in this part of the country, you say something about how you could very easily have become the man who was the incumbent you were running against, and you call that a frightening admission. And yet you didn't. You emerged as somebody very, very different. To what do you attribute that?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. I mean, part of that is, so I grew up in a Republican household, but I describe it as an Eisenhower Republican household that was a thinking household. And I really think the influence of both my father and, this isn't an insult to my dad, but maybe even more so my mother, who was very intellectual, helped give me a foundation of critical thinking, kind of buzzword a little bit, but the ability to think about what's happening at all times and weigh that versus party affiliation in some ways. And even though I am a Democrat, I don't have a strong affinity necessarily toward the Democratic Party as a guiding light in my life. My focus is more on people. And so I think that that was the big difference. And I wasn't a political person. You know, I was just visiting my brother who lives in central Illinois, and I was joking about how at one point in my life, my mother told me that she would be proud of me no matter what I did, unless I became a used car salesman or a politician. So I may have disappointed. Well, I lost the election, so there was no disappointment. But I think the heart of that statement is that the kind of politician she was talking about is the one who is thinking only and always about how to get a vote and doesn't have a moral spine that will stand up against things that might be popular. And that's what I'm talking about with that recognition, is that I think there probably was a point in history where the incumbent may have had, you know, if there was a different Republican Party in control, he might operate differently. But he's been in office most of his adult life and is a political animal in the worst sense of just following where the party is going. And that's where I can see, hey, we both grew up Catholic. We both grew up in conservative households. We both grew up in farming communities. How easy it would have been to listen to the siren song of, if you want to be in political office, you need to be this way, instead of, I want to be who I am, and I want to run on that kind of thing.
Right. And of course,
I think that's the best way to get at it.
And you're touching on something you say repeatedly, which is the major political parties are more interested in winning elections than in anything else. I mean, more interested, right, in that than in, you know, actual governance. I want to return to the whole point about having a moral spine and the willingness and courage to stand up in the face of what might be fierce opposition in cause of something that's right. One of my favorite moments in the book is when you take us back, I think, to your high school years and to something that happened in a local pizza place with a friend of yours named Andy. I think I just want to allow you to at least sketch this really meaningful story and also talk about why that story is here.
Yeah. So I'll start that answer in being a creative writing professor for a second. And when I'm teaching memoir and teaching students on how to approach this genre, it's so important to think about moments that have a resonance through time that you maybe don't always think consciously about. And so that moment at the pizza parlor with Andy and other friends is one of those that, particularly as a political candidate, I found myself thinking about more and more. So the context of the story is a half day. We had a half day from school, and our tradition as a group of friends is we would walk downtown from the high school, which was a little bit outside of town, and go get pizza. You know, it's living the dream of being in high school, or being in high school in the early 1990s, at least. And we were there, and there was another group there of, we were seniors, and they were younger. They were a year younger than us, and it was mostly people on the football team. And one of their friends was, like us, was a nerd. Now, I should say, Andy was a phenomenal swimmer in high school, and several of the other guys at the table were, too. So they were also athletes, but we were all band geeks, and I say that with love and pride. And so this other guy at the other table, who was also a drama kid, pulled the chair out from underneath a linebacker who was one of his friends as a practical joke. And the linebacker just immediately cold cocked him and knocked him to the floor. And it was one of those moments where time freezes and you're face to face with violence. And as a kid, I never wanted to participate in violence. And even more so than as a moral sense, like violence is scary. But my friend Andy immediately stood up at the table and said to this table, other table of football players, "That's not right." And that table kind of primped and preened a little bit in that threatening manner of high school. And Andy just said again, "That's not right." Somehow the scene dissolved and nothing happened. But afterwards, Andy said to us, "None of you stood up with me." And he was exactly right. None of us did, because I think we were all scared of getting into a fight. And that's carried with me in that he had that moral spine to recognize something that was absolutely not okay and stand up and put his body literally in the line of fire. And I carried that with me. I mean, I think I carry a certain guilt of that moment. I wish I had stood up too. And so I wanted to be able to stand up politically when I'm seeing a politics here locally, because what I haven't told you yet about the incumbent is he puts a lot of hateful things out on his Facebook page. I wanted to stand up for the people who are suffering from that hate and to say that that's not the politics that we have to have. And I imagine I'll always be trying to stand up because I didn't when I was a senior in high school.
Right. I guess that's an example of something that you tell us that you say to your students, your creative writing students, write the wounds. So the wounds that we maybe have experienced in our life, even if those wounds are maybe more like guilt or regret. It's also interesting, an interesting story. It comes in a chapter that's titled Violence. And but elsewhere in the book as well, you kind of talk about a certain facet of the overall culture of this part of the country. You call it at one point a place culturally dominated by the gruff rumblings of rural machismo. And and of course, for you, running for political office, this was the landscape. This was the environment. And of course, you were not about to adopt that same sort of profile or personality as a political candidate. It sounds like you tried to remain true to yourself. Tell us about some of the choices that you ultimately made in terms of what was part of your platform and what was sort of at the heart of what you were saying to the citizens of Crawford County.
Yeah, and that'll get me back to some of the hateful stuff that's everything you would anticipate if you imagine a not very kind, very far right-wing candidate, you know, things about migrants, things about members of the LGBTQ community, things about non-white people. I wanted to stand up against that, but I also didn't want to resort to the easiest thing in politics, which is just to start insulting the other person. I certainly put out a lot of information in my campaign about hateful rhetoric that I was pushing back against, and certainly put out lots of things about what I would call hateful policy and how it was harmful to the state and to everybody living in Crawford County. But I wasn't going to take pot shots at the person. And that might be part of, you know, really when I was working on the book, one of my recognitions is that personally, I harbored a lot of negative feelings toward the person, and that's not healthy. But I didn't want to make that the campaign, because that's just a campaign of violence in a different way. That's not standing up against it. That's amplifying violence by picking fights. And I think that's, we have far too much of that in politics. And I'm, in my mind, revising myself as I talk, because it's very easy for a sentence like that to retreat into a both sides problem, or everybody should just be nice issue. And I don't actually think that, because sometimes you have to be fairly strong in resisting bad things. You can't just say, well, let's all get along. That person who's a racist has some fine points, because they don't. You have to call out those points for what they are.
Right. At one point, I'm reminded of one point you say in the book, I have to confess disappointment and annoyance with polite tactics in impolite arenas.
Yeah. Well, because I think it was around there I'm writing about, I had just put out some material that was very pointed about, I don't remember what the issue was per se, and someone privately emailed me and said, well, be careful that you don't get too negative. And that's that desire to be polite consuming the desire to actually get it right. And that's a problem. Martin Luther King talked about that for sure as well, much better than I did.
So we are talking about a place in rural America that seems to be especially hard hit by economic reversals. You tell us Crawford County ranks 56 out of 67 counties in per capita income, and fully a quarter of the people living in Meadville live below the poverty line. And you talk at actually great length about the way in which several different important companies have ultimately abandoned the community. And you especially tell us about one company that made zippers. And you tell us, you know, companies make a fortune, then hop town. The people left behind in the gutted place have to find ways both to fill the void of loss and to pay to clean up messes left behind. And then you go on to talk about how one of the words you hear most often when people are talking in Crawford County is used to. That you call it the dire slogan that defines us. The school that used to be open. The restaurant you used to love. The prosperity that used to be here. It must be so painful to live in a place like that, that has suffered such a precipitous decline, and particularly when you, as somebody running for political office, have, in a sense, limited means to address what's going on. I mean, it's dishonest to pretend that you have some magic pill that's going to turn all of this around. And you even talk about how that sort of siren dream of just let's turn back the clock to the way it used to be, that in itself is a cheat, and that's kind of part of the problem.
Yeah. It's the one of the things that I think about with the Rust Belt history of this part of Pennsylvania, and this is familiar to lots of towns across the country, whether it's farming communities in the Midwest or logging communities out west, coal in Appalachia, manufacturing in the Rust Belt, is that the heyday was a long time ago. You know, here the population peak was, I can't remember the exact year, but it's somewhere around 1950. So that's a long time ago. So 75 years ago was when, right. And so since then, we've had plenty of politics talking about, well, we just need to get back to that. But that's a distortion because we know it's not going to be there. There are reasons, often many of them are political, that companies have left. And we're not going to get them back if we keep playing the game of trying to recruit them by allowing them to not invest in the community. So instead, we need to focus on investment in the community and what that might mean. I'm going to swing that back to an interesting conversation. Just got back from Illinois, so I was having conversations about Illinois politics. And I was talking with somebody about rural broadband, essentially. And she had the same thought that I did, is why don't more people want to live in small towns because they could telecommute to cities and do work, but then live in a small place, which has its own charms. And that's the kind of progress I think could be transformative in resisting the let's make it great again dynamic and said, well, what's the new scenario that can work? I write about in the book in a later chapter about going to a Farm Bureau legislative tour day. And broadband for farmers was one of their chief desires. And they were telling this to all Republican or almost all Republican legislators who essentially were telling, well, it's probably not going to happen, even though it would be a game changer for allowing the kids to stay on the farm. COVID was happening. So to be homeschooled online and have access to the commodity markets they need to pay the bills. That's a forward thinking of imagining investments on the lines of rural electrification that would not take us back to a fancy notion of what was great back in the day and we ignore all the problems, but allow us to think about what we could be if we committed together toward public investment. I spun that a little bit toward the policy way as I was answering it, but I think that's another point where the stories don't allow us to think about the policies that would help. You know, the story is, oh, it was great back when Talon Zipper was here. And it was, but also it wasn't like Talon was at its peak and then left overnight. There was a winding down as those industries shifted. And the refusal to recognize that change and imagine a different way forward is part of what leaves a lot of towns left with nothing. And then accepting a deal that's not good for the town because it's better than nothing.
At one point, you say, you've just touched on one story that is told and the truth of that story. You tell us politics is at heart a literary problem, because politics relies, like so much else, on a shared belief in stories. And this sort of attaches to one of your core beliefs. That you say it at one point, I am pro-poetry. And not just because you teach creative writing at Allegheny College, but you see a purpose in poetry in terms of how we shape our lives, envision the future, dream of new possibilities. I mean, in a sense, a poetic approach to life, you know, you think is what leads to the most exciting possibilities. I wonder to what extent you actually talked about this during this political campaign back in 2020, or was this more of a sort of privately held belief that you knew would not have a whole lot of currency with the typical voter in Crawford County?
I did talk about it. It wasn't the primary plank because I was trying to put out the policy issues. But the main reason I ran, or the first instigation to run, I think it's important to mention this one now, is that during a budget discussion in Harrisburg, our state capital, the incumbent told the other Republicans he was talking to his idea to save money for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania was to not allow financial aid, state-funded financial aid, for any student who, and I'm quoting here, studied poetry or any other pre-Walmart major. And then when that came out and people were mad, he apologized to Walmart. And he's continued to hammer on poets ever since. In fact, just this last year, he was outraged that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania was going to establish a poet laureate. And that was obviously a direct insult to what I do for a living. So that motivated me to want to create change. But then also, at the deeper level, a couple of things are happening there. One is saying that a student is only valuable in as much as they will provide money for the economy, that their own lives and interests aren't valuable. So if you're wealthy, you can be a poet, but if you're not wealthy, you are only valuable in what you're providing for your employer, and so you're not allowed to be a poet. But then even deeper than that is that idea that when we sing songs, when we write poems, when we tell stories, we are engaging with the imaginary world, or the world of the imagination, which is every bit as real as the one we walk in. Eric Liu is a writer who, after the 2016 election, started going around the country and giving what he called civic sermons. And so he called the artist as a citizen a, quote, catalyst for the transformation of community. So poets and writers and artists and philosophers and intellectuals and scientists are people who see a world that could be. And they're so vital to our progress as a nation and as human beings because they allow us to imagine something we hadn't imagined the day before. So it's extraordinarily valuable, even in a dollar sense, but I'm less interested in that. It's extraordinarily valuable to have people from all walks of life being supported in a life built on the mind, because that allows us to see a world different than the one that's been built around us. Hmm. In some ways, that takes me back to the Rust Belt problem of a town that has rightful pride in being the birthplace of the zipper, but also politically, because a lot of people don't have this problem, but politically we have the problem of not imagining a different future for a town that was a zipper manufacturer. Hmm. That's why I think poetry matters as much as anything else in the world.
You say at one point, artists widen the lens of experience. Of course, the problem with talking in those terms, probably anywhere, but particularly maybe in a place like Crawford County, Pennsylvania, is that you are apt to kind of run into the buzzsaw of impracticality. You know, the fact that, yeah, it's great for an artist or a poet to sit and dream of happy future vistas, but that has nothing to do with kind of the nuts and bolts and the brick and mortar and the, you know, what it would take to bring that into being. And I think what you're suggesting is that it's all a part of it. And that to denigrate this kind of person with this kind of vision is to sort of cut ourselves off from what probably can be at least one part of the solution to some of our worst problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of responding to that is the recognition that in the way our economy is structured, the only way that we can have artists is if we support them, not in the marketplace exactly, because, you know, a great way to not make a lot of money is to be a literary writer or a jazz musician. But those things are so important for the world. So we have to recognize that and support individuals because we recognize their value is outside of commerce. The other thing, and I did make this point in the campaign, and I wish I had the statistic in front of me, but I don't, but the arts economy is actually massive in the country and in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. There's a lot of commerce actually happening surrounding the arts. and we never talk about it. And I don't want to quote the manufacturing sectors that are the same as the arts, because I'll get it wrong since I don't have the statistics in front of me. But it's surprising when you look at it that things that most people would say, oh, yeah, that's absolutely economically viable, has the same chunk of the economy as the arts. And so, again, narrative, oh, the arts aren't valuable. Well, they actually are, and they're even more valuable than we think, in both measured in dollars and measured in how we measure our days.
I'm just curious, in the course of your political campaign, I don't remember you talking about this in the book, but maybe I just missed it. Did you ever think about or attempt to project a certain persona that you thought would be more immediately familiar to the typical folks of Crawford County? I mean, were you one of these progressive candidates that, you know, tried to wear, you know, flannel shirts and a feed store cap and maybe, you know, slightly simplify your vocabulary and maybe tell the most down-to-earth sort of stories? I mean, how much of this was about that versus just putting yourself out there as exactly who Matthew Ferentz is when he just walks around in the world not running for office?
Yeah, I think I would have been a much better politician if I had tried some of those things. But I tried to run as fully authentically as I am, because what I came to recognize is that the value in running for office in a place where you're likely to lose badly, in my case, which was inevitable, is to put forth counter narratives to what everybody expects. And so I did show goats at the county fair when I was a kid, but I do also have a PhD. Those things are not incompatible. And so I didn't want to try to pretend to be someone I wasn't. But I did think about that as I was launching into the campaign. And the story that I think comes to mind most of all is when I was thinking about the signs that I would have designed for me. A friend of mine who is a graphic designer helped me out with that. The ones that, you know, you put out in front of somebody's house. I've thought about color schemes. Like, how do you signal something through the color scheme of sign? I mean, I'm a nerd, so I overthink everything. And the colors of Allegheny College are a deep blue and gold. And I knew that one of my chief liabilities as a candidate was that I am a professor at Allegheny College. And we talked about it, and we decided to not run away from that. So we used essentially very close to the colors of the college as the color scheme of my sign. I thought it was an attractive sign too. And that was part of that recognition in a small way. I am who I am. And me being a creative writing professor from Western Pennsylvania who lives in this town is part of this town, is part of this county. And I'm not going to pretend that I'm not that. And there's way too many politicians that I can think of several off the top of my head, and this is not exclusive to any political party, who do put on some kind of headwear or sweatshirt or jacket to portray themselves as being something that might be part of who they are, but isn't really who they are. And I find that endlessly annoying and frustrating. Yeah, condescending is maybe the worst word I can find for it.
Matthew Ferentz is the author of I Hate It Here, Please Vote for Me, Essays on Rural Political Decay, published by West Virginia University Press. And in part one of tomorrow's morning show, that is Tuesday's morning show, we will hear more from Matthew Ferentz, the author of this really interesting book called I Hate It Here, Please Vote for Me. And looking ahead to later in the week, both Wednesday and Thursday will be devoted to interesting morning shows about the upcoming Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival, which is Saturday. We'll talk to the musical headliner Jonathan Butler on Wednesday, and to a first-rate chef who's going to be part of the cooking studio on Thursday. Today, partly sunny and warm, a high of 79 degrees, partly cloudy overnight, low of 58. Tomorrow, sunny and a high of 83 degrees, identical forecast on Wednesday. Right now, it's looking like a decent chance of rain, both on Thursday and Friday. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, WPR News.